We continue with an educational session on revenue recognition.
Great. And thanks, Brian, for joining us so early for the FASB.
Good morning. I have Nick and Vicky here with me, too. They chose to set off camera.
Hello, everyone. Welcome. We have three papers to discuss today. One on collectability, another one on what happens when a contract fails step one of the model, and third one on constraints, specifically the minimums requirements. These comments and the reason why we're here today is based on some feedback that we received as part of the external review process. I'm sure you all received an email last night and printed copies on your desk of the additional paper. Glenn will walk us through paper A, but he'll also walk us through that paper as well in detail. So I'll turn it over to Glenn.
Good morning, everyone. Good to see you all again. So today we'll start off, as Alison said, talking about collectability. And this is in paper 7A and also in the handouts that we've distributed last night, as Alison mentioned. I'll talk first about paper A and then I'll walk you through the handouts. So really, paper A considers how assessments about customer credit risk should be reflected in accounting for contracts with customers. In particular, we're talking about accounting for contracts with no significant financing component and the relationship of credit risk there. The paper starts off by giving a little bit of background, mentions the core principle of the revenue model, and that core principle is based on revenue being recognised at the amount to which the entity is entitled to in exchange for goods or services. And essentially that means that the revenue is recognised at an amount which is not adjusted for customer credit risk. And there is a slight exception with significant financing components, and that's why we haven't sort of addressed that in that part of the paper. The paper is then structured so that we go through and we talk a bit about what the board's decision was in November of last year. And that decision was to reaffirm that the transaction price should be measured and revenue should be measured at the entitled amount, and any corresponding impairment loss that's recognised is not presented as we had proposed in the 2011 ED adjacent to revenue, but would be presented below the line in other expenses. But that presentation of the impairment loss should be a prominent presentation. As you know, we've been working through drafts of the final standard, and so other aspects of the paper talk about the relevant parts of the draft standard that deal with customer credit risk type matters. And that's also presented in the appendix, and those paragraphs include paragraph 14, which is essentially designed to determine whether you have a contract with the customer that's within the scope of the revenue model. And that's really looking at whether the contract has commercial substance and the parties to the contract are committed to their rights and obligations in the contract. And so one of the things to think about there is whether the customer has the intent to perform their obligations under the contract, which might include whether they intend to pay for the goods or services that they will receive under the contract. We have also clarified in paragraph 50 and 53 that there might be some cases where essentially the entity will not have an entitlement to the stated contract price, and that might be because it offers a price concession to customers. So, i.e., it's willing to extend a discount to the customer for those goods or services. And paragraph 53.1, paragraph B, sort of makes the point, and this was a clarification that we made, that in some cases, if there is significant doubt about collectability of the amount of promised consideration from the customer, and the entity knows that at contract inception, that might suggest that the entity has implicitly decided that it might offer a price concession to the customer because it knows that there's doubt about the customer being able to pay the full amount, but it's still willingly, knowingly entered into that contract with the customer. Now, as you know, we've had some drafts. We've shared them with you and we've shared them with some external reviewers. And in this area, we've got two pieces of feedback, and that's what paper 7A really deals with. The first piece of feedback is more dealing with some drafting type issues, some concern about some apparent overlaps between some of these paragraphs I've just mentioned, in particular paragraphs 14 and paragraphs 50 and 53.1, where sometimes it was a little unsure to people when they read it as to how do I know whether I've got a contract with some customer credit risk. Does that mean I should be assessing whether or not I have a contract within the scope of the model? Or does that mean I should assess whether I do have a contract, the customer appears to be committed, but I may be offering a price concession? And so there's a little bit of uncertainty about how do I analyse that contract. And that was also one of the feedback we received was about whether there might be partial performance by the entity or the customer. How does that affect the assessment? And there was a sort of a jarring bit of what some people viewed as a contradiction, where we say in paragraph 52 that transaction price is not adjusted for customer credit risk, and then people read two paragraphs later in paragraph 53.1 said, oh, well, customer credit risk might affect the measurement of the transaction price because it might indicate the willingness of the entity to offer an implicit price concession. And the second bit of feedback was largely about people were unsure as to, well, how do I know whether I've really offered a price concession or should I be assessing for customer credit risk as an impairment? And there was just a lot of it wasn't clear to people when they read the standard that they would know in practice how they should make that assessment. So the paper addresses those two areas of feedback separately. And so section one deals with the sort of the apparent overlap between the paragraphs. And if you move on to, I think it's around paragraphs 17 through to 22, that sort of deals with those sort of those issues and clarifications. And questions 1, 2, and 3 reflect, I guess, some recommendations, which would be to clarify paragraph 14, possibly eliminate the second sentence of 50, and the sentence in 53.1 about significant doubts about collectability, and instead maybe add some additional guidance which just tries to better explain how we think those assessments about customer credit risk should be dealt with. And primarily that would be using some of the guidance we talk about in the second part of the paper. This first part of the paper is dealing with sort of smaller drafting issues. The main...
Which you would want to do in any of the alternatives, right?
Yes.
Yes.
The second part of the paper is dealing with the probably the more fundamental issue of, okay, I've entered into a contract with a customer. There is some doubt about collectability. There is some customer credit risk. How should I reflect that? Price concession, have I essentially offered a price concession, maybe implicitly, and that suggests I've got variable consideration, and I therefore need to estimate, well, what do I expect to be entitled to under that contract using either an expected value technique or a most likely amount technique, and also considering that the constraint applies, because the constraint applies to all types of variable consideration. Alternatively, is it essentially just like an impairment, in which case I recognise revenue gross, the 100% amount of entitlement, but then show my expectation or however you determine the impairment loss under the financial instrument standards as an impairment loss. However, that's to be determined. So we've presented for the board two alternatives to consider as a way to clarifying that distinction between whether it's an impairment issue or a price concession. Alternative A would be to retain the approach that we have in the draft, but provide some additional clarification, some additional guidance to help an entity make that assessment as to whether it's an impairment loss or a price concession that's been implicitly offered in the contract. And from paragraphs, I think about 28 to 36, we outline what some of that guidance might contain, and it might be providing a bit of more of an explanation of how you might distinguish between customer credit risk and variable consideration. Suggests that there's some facts and circumstances that an entity might consider in making that assessment of when consideration might be variable, identifying some attributes where price concessions are more likely to be offered in contracts, and some assessment of other evidence that might be available. For instance, has the entity undertaken an effort to genuinely try to enforce its rights to the consideration under the contract? Or has the entity previously agreed to accept a partial payment as full payment for the debt from the customer, but then willingly then entered into another contract with that customer, notwithstanding their previous experience? Another alternative would be to say, well, judgment is going to be required in assessing whether you've got an impairment loss or a price concession. So to reduce, I guess, the tension associated with that judgment, what we could do instead is require that any, as we proposed in the 2011 ED, require the presentation of an impairment loss to be presented adjacent to the revenue line. So that means if you were to say, okay, I've got this contract, I don't know how to account for it. Should I account for it as a price cession? Should I account for it as an impairment? At least, however you choose to account for it, it would be essentially co-located. The price concession would be reflected in the measurement of the revenue on the top line. If you assessed it's an impairment, it would be presented directly beneath the revenue line. Now, with alternative B, we would propose that we clarify that, and this was an issue in the 2011 ED, if you had that adjacent presentation of the impairment loss line, that subtotal that occurs after that, we would say that subtotal is revenue. It is net revenue. So regardless of how you make that assessment, whether it's price concession or impairment, both would affect revenue. Now, I guess in terms of the paper, we considered those two alternatives, and the staff recommendation was to acknowledge it's a sort of a challenging area, and there are sort of pros and cons of both approaches. We did acknowledge that we do think that the added clarification with alternative A, i.e. sticking with the staff draft but providing some greater clarification improvements in the drafting, could help ease some of these concerns about how you make the distinction. But obviously, judgment would still be required. Alternatively, with alternative B, we're reducing the sort of the effect of that judgment by co-locating the presentation of the impairment loss and the revenue. The one thing to keep in mind there, though, is if it's an impairment loss, whilst we might say it's part of revenue, that it could lead to some differences in accounting, because if it's a price concession, we're saying the price concession makes the entity's entitlement to consideration variable, and therefore it's subject to the constraint. And if the constraint were to apply, that could lead to essentially no revenue being recognised at the time of transfer, and revenue only being recognised at some later point when the uncertainty associated with that consideration is resolved. So the difference between alternative B and A won't necessarily always just be where you locate it, it could also have a timing effect as well. Now, we discussed this with the FASB at their education session last week, and as part of that discussion, there was also thoughts about another approach that might be able to be sort of considered in considering how to deal with this. And we have presented this approach in this handout, and we've called it Alternative C. And so what I might do is I might walk you through that handout, because I know you've only just received it. We've presented this. It's a fairly full description in a sense, because we wanted you to be clear as to how it might work. But there are parts of the model parts of this alternative where some further thought may be required as well. So perhaps with Alternative C, I think the key point to note is what we would say is when an entity enters into a contract that has significant credit risk, the entity is deemed to offer discounts or price concessions to the customer. So that sort of removes an area of judgment. If you've entered into a contract knowingly with a customer with significant credit risk, then you have been deemed to offer a price concession. That then makes the consideration variable and makes it subject to the constraint. Now, under Alternative C, we would say that the measurement of that transaction price and therefore revenue would be based on the amount that the entity expects the customer to pay. So it would be based on a similar sort of measurement notion that we had in our 2010 ED, based on our expectations of the amount to receive or collect from the customer. A further implication or consequence of this approach is that any remeasurements or reassessments of the customer's ability to pay would be reflected in a remeasurement of the transaction price and therefore revenue. So all changes, all reassessments would go through revenue. As a consequence, there would be no impairment losses recognised for these subsets of contracts. Everything would go through the revenue line. Now, we've prepared on pages 2 and 3 some four basic examples which just sort of illustrate how this might work. So I might quickly just run through those with you. Example one, and so this is on page 3, and as you can see, we've divided the examples into alternative A, alternative B, and alternative C. Alternative A is just the staff draft with some clarification about what's a price concession, what's an impairment. Alternative B is the adjacent presentation of impairment loss line, and alternative C is this alternative I've just discussed. So in the first example, if we assume normal credit risk, customer has normal credit risk, there's no evidence to suggest the customer is going to offer a price concession, but subsequently to entering into the contract, an event occurs which suggests that the entity is not going to be able to recover full amount of consideration from the customer, but that's regarded as an impairment event. Under alternative A and alternative B, the entitled amount is the promised consideration of 100. So revenue will be recognised at 100.
Can you be more specific about the type of external event which happens? Can you reduce this by 50? Is it an event which is credit risk related?
Yes.
Or is it an event due to the performance?
It's credit risk. Okay. It might be, you know, basically
it's important,
running,
it's important because the nature of the event should have some impact on the accounting for that event.
So there could be doubts about the solvency of the customer or something in this case. So we would show the revenue at the sort of the gross, the entitlement amount, which would be a fixed amount of consideration, i.e. the $100. And then we would show the impairment. And the difference between alternative A and B is just the location of where that impairment loss is presented.
Well, but it's a bit bigger difference than that. It gives you a different revenue figure.
It does.
Yeah, and so that's pretty substantial difference.
Yes. I mean, that's a consequence of, the alternative B, as you'll see later down, but that's certainly right here. So it changes presentation, but in doing so, it sort of has an effect as to what is the ultimate revenue number in those two cases. And that impairment, obviously, is a subsequent event. So revenue on day one is the same in both cases.
Revenue subsequently is quite different.
It's different, yeah. Now, in alternative C, we've said that's not applicable. Why is it not applicable? Because alternative C only applies to contracts with a significant credit risk component, and this example does not have that. Example two. So here we have an example where there's a price concession in the contract, but that price concession we've assumed relates solely to more quality performance type issues, not related to customer credit risk, but we have noted that there is customer credit risk in the transaction. So in this case, the initial estimate of the price concession that will be offered is 40. So that makes the consideration, whilst the stated contract price was 100, the entity has to estimate what the consideration will be entitled to is and estimates that to be 60 on day one. So in both alternative A and alternative B, revenue is 60 on day one. Subsequently, the entity determines that there's going to be a further price concession offered, so a further 10 of the promised consideration will be subject to a discount. So that reduces the revenue in both cases by 10. Under alternative C, it would deliver the same outcomes as under A and B. Under example three, in this case, a price concession is expected. Again, there's customer credit risk. And the reason why a price concession is expected is based on the entity's past business practices, which indicates that the entity customarily accepts less than full payment for its goods and services. So in that case, it's sort of offering an implicit price concession. So again, it's the same sort of expectation. Initially, a price concession is expected of 40, so that means revenue would be recognised at the 60, based on its estimation. And that would be the same under alternative A, B, and C. Subsequently reassess, that would affect the revenue, so a subsequent adjustment to revenue of 10. Now, the real issue which, or the, and the real example which illustrates the potential differences in the interpretation under alternative C versus the others is in example 4. So here we have, again, a customer has a high credit risk. There's no contractual requirements that the entity is going to provide a price concession. But the fact of the customer credit risk indicates that, you know, a price an implicit price concession may be provided. The fact that there's a high degree of customer credit risk means the entity has to make this judgment. How do I account for this credit risk? Should I account for it as an implicit price concession, or should I sort of acknowledge that there might be an impairment loss expected? Now, in this case, under alternative A and B, we've assumed that the entity, in weighing up those factors, falls on the side of saying, okay, it's an impairment loss. So in that case, under A, it would recognise revenue at the full stated amount of 100, recognise the impairment, expected impairment of 40, and that would be shown as an expense. Under alternative B, that impairment would be shown adjacent to revenue and would form part of, therefore, net revenue. So net revenue would be 60 in that case. Now, under the alternative C, it effectively removes some of that judgment. An entity sort of weighing up, do I have an impairment or implicit price concession? What alternative C would say is no. You've entered into a contract with a customer with a significant credit component. You are deemed to have offered a price concession. So that would say that the revenue is adjusted to 60.
Why is there less judgment in determining this 60 in alternative C than in determining the impairment of 40, hence a net revenue of 60 in alternative B? The judgment on what you will collect is the same. But you just go directly to a presentation of the net instead of showing the growth and the reduction, which in my opinion is probably more informative than presenting the net. But the judgment to determine that reduction is the same. Or maybe I missed something.
The judgment in the measurement will be the same, because we're sort of saying it's based on the amount the entity expects to collect or expects to receive. The difference in the judgment relates to assessing, do I have a price concession or do I have impairment, and under alternative A, that affects, as Ian pointed out before, that affects what your revenue number is. Is it going to be 100 or is it going to be 60? And so that has one effect. The other issue with alternative C is what it means is, because it's variable consideration in all of these cases, it will be subject to the constraints. So in some cases, the constraint may not be passed, in which case revenue would be recognised at nil at the time of transfer, and the amount of revenue, you know, the 60 or whatever the amount is, would only be recognised as revenue at a subsequent point when the uncertainty associated with the variable consideration is resolved, which might be when the customer pays the consideration.
Greg, is there one other difference between B and C? And that is, in these examples, we're only looking at one contract, you know, which is, we know why we're doing that. However, in the accounting under B, all impairments, whether they're related to high risk or not, whether they were built in, all of them will come up to that 40 figure.
That's right.
So that 40 figure might be 100, because you're going to mix previous years' impairments, all sorts of things into it. Whereas an alternative C, you'll only be assessing it for the contract this year. What do you do with impairments that come up later on other contracts? Do they go below the line or do they go up with the revenue?
So under alternative C, we have assumed that all we would change from the staff draft is this account contracts with a significant credit component. So as a consequence, any impairments related to normal type contracts with customers would be presented, you know, below the line in other expense. Obviously, the boards could decide still if they wanted the presentation
My mind, C makes much more sense than B, because the mixing of all those things up in the revenue figure has just never made any sense to me.
Now, the consequence of C could be is that revenue changes from period to period as you reassess the customer credit risk.
Sure, of course.
And Glenn, doesn't C put much more pressure on whether you view it as significant credit risk or slightly less than a significant credit risk?
Yeah, so you've still got to make a judgment about whether the contract with the customer has significant credit risk or not. So you're not removing complete judgment from this assertion. But that might be able to be assessed on slightly more objective factors, such as the pricing of the contract. If it's obvious that the pricing includes a premium for the entity assuming a significant credit risk, or there might be other information about the sort of the customer's credit report or something that suggests that they are a significant credit risk. The difference between under alternative A and B is you're more assessing the intent. What is the intent of the entity in this transaction? Is it to offer a price concession, or is it to try to enforce full payment? And that I guess making assessments on the basis of intent might be more subjective than assessing whether a contract has a significant credit risk component, because that could be based on more objective data.
So if I get this right, I send something, I expect to have 15% loss. That's significant. Then it goes into the revenue line in C. I have another customer I expect to lose 5, which is less than significant. Then I will have the impairment in a separate line.
Well, it depends what you class as significant. So
I just classified it. 5% is less than significant. So then it goes into an impairment line.
That's
so
right.
I have two different places to see the impairments.
Well, in one case, you won't really see for the high risk, you won't really see the impairment. You'll just see the fluctuation in the revenue line. But
but they're in two different places.
Yeah, and the problem is, you don't see anything. You don't see the impairment. You see the net. You don't have information about that impairment amount.
Yeah.
So there is a threshold. Up to a certain point, you see the impact, and beyond that point, you don't see anything.
But I guess and one of the reasons why we've sort of been thinking about this, and one of the reasons I think for alternative C, is if there was an entity has entered into a contract with a customer that has a significant credit risk, would recognizing revenue at the contractually stated price be the most useful information to users if there's significant doubt as to whether that amount of consideration will ever be collected? And so what alternative C and to some extent alternative A is trying to get to is, if there is essentially the entity has entered into the contract intending to offer a price concession, more useful information would be trying to measure what that price concession would be and use that to adjust the revenue.
Glenn, how transparent would these judgments be to the reader of the financial statements? So, for example, as you said and as Pat's question highlights and Jan's example highlights, there's a judgment here in how you define significant credit risk. If, in fact, you make that judgment and you decide to truncate revenue, okay, to the amount you expect to receive as opposed to the amount you're entitled to, is that going to be transparent that the vendor made that judgment and you have X amount of revenue that's classified that way versus revenue that's classified the other way? Or is this going to be kind of a guessing game to the reader of the financial statements? That's number one. Number two is, use in your example the term high credit risk, and the principle is couched in the word significant. I don't know whether there's meant to be gradations or degrees there.
Using interchangeable language. Sorry, that wasn't.
So the one thing that I do like about alternative C is what you said. There seems to be an ability to anchor this in more objective evidence, right? Making that assessment. The only concern I have is the transparency around it, because as some people said, you might be essentially understating your true amount of impairment losses through this approach. And impairment losses and revenue numbers obviously are key numbers that people put multiples on to come up with valuations. The other concern I said to you yesterday is, if you go down path A or B, I have a concern that if the price concession is not a matter of documented or agreed status between the vendor and the customer, that there isn't a objective amount of evidence you can say that I'm potentially going to offer you a price concession, then you can book the revenue at the higher number, and at any point in time in the course of the contract, decide to classify really an impairment loss as a price concession. Okay? So in my mind, there's got to be, it can't be a unilateral decision to decide today I'm going to make it a price concession, tomorrow I'm going to make it an impairment loss. There has to be a meeting of the mind, some kind of documentation that, in fact, the customer has the expectation that a price concession is possible. They may not know exactly the amount, but it is possible. Otherwise, I think there's a lot of room for gamesmanship with, frankly, either A or B. So the only choice that I thought really dealt with that risk effectively was paragraph 31B, where it's you have this documented meeting of the minds, if so to speak. But management's intent or the possibility without it being documented, in my mind, is too loosey-goosey.
So I'll just sort of respond just quickly to those things. So in terms of visibility of the adjustments to revenue, what would the user see? Well, because it will be variable consideration and changes in variable consideration, we do have some disclosures relating to variable consideration. But there's nothing proposed that's specific to dealing with changes in revenue relating to changes in assessment of customer credit risk. So it would be just normal disclosures about variable considerations. And so that could also affect other things such as returns, other types of discounts for quality issues that wouldn't be broken out, unless there was perhaps significance associated with that, and then the entity decided to disclose for that reason. So the proposal is for significant credit risk, you would be under alternative C. Disregard my comment about high credit risk. In terms of the other thing about sort of implicit price concessions, we have sort of acknowledged in the paper that there could be implicit price concessions. Often we would expect that would be evidenced by customary business practices or anything, so an entity couldn't just sort of purport to say, oh, well, I might offer a price concession. So there should be some evidence that sort of backs the entity's assertions that a price concession may be offered. To the extent that there isn't that evidence and the entity doesn't make that assertion, the impairment requirements would still kick in. So you would assess if revenue was recognised at the stated contract price of 100, you would still assess that sort of contract asset receivable for impairment.
So I would view a weakness of alternative C would be the lack of transparency around those judgments being made. While I kind of like the idea of truncating revenue, clearly when you know somebody isn't going to be able to pay, a weakness of it is I don't know how you or when you made that judgment. So there's a pro and a con to that.
Glenn, from before, people are getting very excited, I think. But I don't really understand the background of this whole issue that keeps on popping up. We've been discussing this many times. First of all, is this a situation that arises quite regularly? Is this something that is very important, first of all? And secondly, is the background of our discussions the fear of abuse, which, I mean, I'm not one of those who say we should not try to address abuse in our stance. I think we should. If we can prevent abuse, we should. If we can prevent it easily. But if that is the case, will either of these variables, variants, which all have a huge amount of judgment in them, they seem to me all equally open to abuse, and is there really a big difference between the three in terms of preventing it? But is this the silent background of this problem?
To a degree, I mean, revenue, as we always hear, is special, very important, it's top line. It sort of is a starting point for a lot of analysis, assessment of sort of entities' financial performance, and revenue is also used for other purposes, such as compensating management and things of that nature. So a lot of attention is placed on revenue. Existing standards typically have a collectability threshold, which you would have to pass before you can recognise revenue. And that's on the basis of probable future economic benefits or collectability is reasonably assured. So that can result in contracts in which there is significant doubt about collectability not passing that threshold. And so you have to wait until later before revenue can be recognised. We have not added a collectability threshold in our model. Our model is based on whether or not you recognise revenue when goods or services transfer to the customer, and that's the primary basis for recognising revenue, and then recognise revenue at the entitled amount. So as a consequence, you could have, and this is, I guess, the concern, you could have a case where you've entered into a contract with someone with significant credit risk, so doubts about whether you'll collect the consideration, but you would recognise the revenue at the stated contract price. Now, what alternative A does is we would require, well, that receivable that you would recognise from that contract would still be subject to impairment testing. So you would still see the impairment charge that might be associated with that, and it might be quite significant.
Yeah.
So a user would look at that, and they should not look at revenue in isolation of everything else. They should see, oh, revenue is high, impairment charge high. Raises questions about the quality of the revenue number. Alternative B, to some extent, by having the adjacent presentation of the impairment loss line to revenue, just makes that more obvious, that there is this linkage between the revenue and the impairment. But as sort of Ian has said before, one of the common complaints about alternative B was not everyone enters into contracts with higher credit risk customers. And so you may have a lot of giving undue attention perhaps to the impairment line having it adjacent to revenue, because for many companies the impairment loss might be insignificant, and it might sort of add some confusion because impairments might occur in subsequent periods to when the revenue is recognised. So
this was Hans' first question. How often, and if I was going to give him an answer, and I don't know as much as you, I would say most of the time you're just dealing with customers, you get a bit of impairment here and there, but you don't go in with an expectation of impairment. You know from history that this is. Yep. So that we're dealing here with the minority of the time.
Yes.
Where so this is, I don't know, put a percentage on, 2% of the transactions that go through, and if you go to alternative B, you're going to move all impairments up to the top line for this 2% that are on.
Yeah. I think if you looked at the population, the global population of contracts with customers, you'd probably say, yes, it's not. It's a small minority of contracts where you have this. But particularly industries, this is a greater concern. And the software industry is one where in some parts of the industry, they might be willingly entering into contracts with customers with significant credit risk because their cost to them to push products out is very low. They've already incurred the cost, some costs. Healthcare in the US is another example where the credit risks can be quite high, and real estate transactions, particularly in the US, based on their existing gap, there's a lot of concern about credit risk there as well. And timeshares.
Okay, you were at B and now you were going to C.
And then I think with C, what C does is it sort of says where you do have significant credit risk, just adjust the revenue in all cases. So that would mean if you do have entered into a contract, say contract price is 100, and you assess a high degree of customer credit risk, such you only expect to collect 60 or 40, let's say, you only expect to collect 40, you would recognise revenue at the 40. So that wouldn't really overstate the amount of revenue you expect from that customer, because you've got no real expectation of collecting the 100, therefore why recognise revenue at that amount? Perhaps it's better and more useful to recognise revenue in those cases at the amount you expect to receive.
Okay. Gary.
Thanks. A couple of thoughts, Glenn, because I'll just stay on the interest of time. Example 4. I agree with a couple of comments other people made, I don't remember whom. If you start working on alternative C, I think you'll lose a lot of transparency just netting it. I think it's not even so much transparency. I think the classic credit loss, bad debt reserve, uncollectible accounts, are highly visible, highly focused on numbers by both management and by users. And the famous thing is I think you'll lose good information in general under C. Under B, going back to before I joined the board, I didn't like whatever B was called then. because you're, to some extent, you're cluttering up the face of the income statement. That should be a very high-level snapshot of your overall performance. And impairment losses, in some ways, are just another operating expense. You know, whether it's a revenue deduction or operating cost, we can perhaps debate, but they're just another cost doing business. So I would sort of get back to, in general, I like alternative A, and I might suggest the way to think there's the way you've organized the paper, particularly, you know, the addendum from last night, and there's two types of, I'll call it, high credit risk. There's high credit risk that's just industry practice, and that's what you have all three, large numbers of healthcare self-pay patients. You just know from day one you're never going to see that money, so it's high credit risk. And, you know, I think you wait for Medicare, then you wait for your supplemental, then your own private insurance, and 8 months later, you know, when you get $4, you know, for the patient, you know, get collected, this is known. Then there's what I would think is the classic impairment expense. By the way, in that first example there, I think that probably is a revenue deduction because it's that type of credit, so you never expected to get it. That's more the price concession, I think, but impairment expense, when you, there's no particular dispute on the terms, the deliverables, or the amounts, they just can't pay. For whatever reason, you know, they go bankrupt, the unforeseen events, whatever, I think that's an operating expense. You know, we call impairment expense here, but I think it's in the expense, cost and expense section of the lines. I think the easiest way to think about impairment is, they should be able to pay. There's no particular dispute. They just can't pay. And I think that's the right way to look at impairment expenses in this project.
There you go.
Okay. I don't know whether we want to make a decision this time or not.
No.
Education.
No. This week or not.
Well, we already have a decision. This is going to change.
I feel it become much harder, you know, to vote for me. It's because, you know, we already made several times different decisions on this issue, and it seems, you know, even though you say the principal is entitled on the gross amount, and we will not have a credibility threshold. But now we are changing our ideas, based on my understanding. So I really feel, you know, we have to be very careful, you know. If we want to go that road, it will be no end. You know, you already take into consideration credibility or credit risk, return, price concessions, value payment, others, and all related to the amount you expected to pay, to receive, rather than entitled. And my feeling is, if you want to go more to that direction, it will be no end. And I will personally feel, you know, unless we want to change our previous decision, I personally feel, you know, if you don't want to change the previous decision, we keep the decision. That is, the revenue should be the amount expected to be entitled. You not take into any considerations of the credit risk. And otherwise, we'll confuse ourselves and we contradict ourselves. And secondly, I would rather prefer, no, if we really want to take into those these kind of things considerations, and I would rather prefer B. And if we want, I think back to the decision we made about 3 years ago, I think November in Novaka, we made such a decision. And remember, during that time, we feel the goodness of and long adjacent to revenue is to enhance transparency. And when we once discussed, if follow that road, we should have a comprehensive notes, and if possible, you know, to line out the credit risk part, return, and the price concession, and others, and possibly there may be different time, lines because of the transaction. So I really don't know, you know, the what do you want us to go ahead, you know, based on the previous decision or not based on previous decision. Simply, I would say, you know, if the decision we don't want Chen that is entitled, and then that amount should be the gross amount in the contract and face amount, all the others should be in the second line. You can give a name, may not be called impairment because they have a return, price concession, and others. And lastly, can I ask you, if follow B, I don't know where the board would make decision, if we want to follow B, will you keep the paragraph 14E?
We would keep 14E, but not the sub-paragraphs underneath.
Now, I will firmly against putting to 14E. It's because, you know, it's confused, confused, entitled, and expected. Confused confused the impairment issues with the, you know, remedy recognition issues, and confused ourselves whether we really have a credibility threshold or not. My understanding is, you know, you at E seems, you know, you set the credibility threshold in. And lastly, you know, we always, the board always be very careful to add intention in our standards. And now, here you put something in, you know, you set amount, standard contract, the amount is 1,000, but the sailor not intend to enforce it. It seems, you know, I feel it is hard to understand, you know, this is contractually, you have 1,000 entitled, but now you say you not intend to enforce 1,000 amount, and I think if it is true contract, and that amount should be entitled, and we should not deduct any amount from that. If we want to keep our decision, that is, value is the amount you expected to be entitled.
Yeah. And we are keen to, and we are proposing to keep the core principle as based on entitlement. But where there is sort of a price concession which may be stated in the contract, or if we acknowledge through customary business practice it's implicit in the contract, that offer of a concession or a discount makes the amount of consideration to which the entity is entitled variable based on what will be the amount of the price concession that's offered. And so that's where, and this is where the intersection comes with customer credit risk, is that there may be some circumstances in which the entity is intending to provide a price concession to the customer in order to encourage them to maybe pay or perform or whatever. And perhaps with what we've tried to do on the basis of feedback from reviewers is to provide a bit more guidance, a bit more clarification to assist an entity to make that assessment. Is there an implicit price concession in the contract? If there is, then you've got variable consideration. It's still estimating the entitled amount of consideration. If there's not an implicit price concession, the entitled amount of consideration is the stated contract price, and then you just assess that for impairment.
So that reasoning would go, for example, for the software industry where you were talking about, invariant A also.
Or yes, so if for instance, an entity was to, you know, sold to a higher credit risk customer and stated contract price was 100, but there's customary practice that they discount to the customer based on, you know, for whatever reason. That would suggest that the entitled amount of consideration is not 100. It would be in a lower amount, but you'd have to estimate as to what that is. And I guess the important point is, if you've got no reasonable basis for making that estimate, such that there's a risk that there could be a significant revenue reversal, the constraint would step in and say, well, you can't recognise revenue.
Also on the very end. And Glenn, just to clarify again on that point, so to me, the difference between A and C, and I, you know, we only got this paper very recently, is in A you have to make a judgment whether it's a price concession, and those sort of things that you're just talking about form part of your judgment.
That's right.
In C, it's deemed, if you've got a significant credit risk, it's deemed to be a price concession, and that's the difference between A and C. So that could almost be regarded as another clarification. You know, I mean, it's not really a different method, and I think you actually...
I don't think it is very good.
Your example 4 is a little bit misleading in that regard, I think, because it could well be in A that you've decided there's a price concession anyway.
That's right. So and that's the thing. I guess what example 4 is saying is, well, the answer could be different depending on whether it's considered to be a price concession or an impairment, and we sort of just tried to acknowledge that by saying, well, you fall on one side.
Taking the arbitrage out, because you know, the key difference, well, an important difference that Glenn mentioned, but perhaps you don't sort of perhaps see strongly in example 4, is that if you've called it as being an impairment, then you recognise the revenue when you satisfy the performance obligation. So day one, as it says here, and you book the impairment. But if you'd called it to be a price concession, it's subject to the constraint. Potentially, that means that you wouldn't recognise any revenue at that point. So, you know, it's not just presentation. I just want to emphasise there's a timing.
But would you recognise 60 or 0?
Well, and if you failed the constraint, it could potentially be
0.
It could potentially be 0.
That's slightly more conservative.
Yeah.
BK.
Glenn, thanks for coming over and thanks for thanks for explaining this issue. Can I ask you one question, though? Under the both U.S. GAAP and IFRS as it exists today, price concession is a reduction of revenue, and impairment is a bad debt expense. I appreciate that there is a collectability threshold in the current literature, so it avoids. But isn't it a issue even in current GAAP, keeping aside the collectability, and do we hear any noise about that? I did not see any of the comment letters in the past about this issue being a big issue between a price concession and people generally. I was speaking to Gary as a previous chief accounting officer of a large corporation. Did he have any difficulty separating in his mind what is a price concession, what is an impairment? And I think Gary told me, if I don't put words into your mouth, you said that
you will.
I'm speaking in Indian English. No, I think Gary said he didn't have any difficulty, for the most part, vast majority, to separate those two. What is a price concession?
I think,
and what is a bad debt? I think that's important. Keeping aside the collectibility threshold for a second, it's important to understand where price concession, where the impairment.
No, in American English, I think we should operate. The companies know their business and they know why they're collecting their money or not collecting their money. It's really that simple. And some things which intend to happen don't happen. That's why I kind of kept the example impairment simple. I expect to get the money. There's no particular disputes, but for some whatever reason, despite workouts, they can't pay. And you end up taking 60 in your example as opposed to 40, because that's the best you can do in your workout, as opposed to common industry practice, be it software, be it the small healthcare payer. You never expected to get the 100 in that example. You knew it. It's more like a list price as a place to begin from. In that case, I think that would be a revenue adjustment from day one.
So I think the important thing here is to perhaps think about, because there are, I personally, you guys know that, I personally favored alternative C right from get-go. But the problem is now alternative C from get-go in 2010, but that did not fly because of various reasons. Alternative C brings in a collectibility threshold at a different level. Remember one thing, we have a line between what is a price concession and what is a bad debt right now. That's a judgment call. We are moving the judgment call, like Jan or somebody asked the question, if I have a 15%, is it significant? If I have, so you're moving the line from this to another line that is so significant credit risk. We already have a significant financing component. That accounting is different from this. Now you're putting another line called significant credit risk. Then the question, like you correctly pointed out, sequencing between those two. I think, I feel,
that having thought through this, having done this, I think the fear about revenue deferral, closing the tap, so to speak, or opening the tap, so to speak, perhaps, in my personal view, might be a little bit exaggerated, because most of these contracts, when you have this, they are in a portfolio approach. Or you do an expected value approach. In an expected value approach, the minimum amount comes down. That fear is not there. So you book the revenue. It's not like you close this at 0 or 60 in that example.
Right.
It generally doesn't happen that way. You say, what is your expected value?
Right.
And once you know that expected value, you book that. You're not going to put 0. Most cases. I think going for the alternative C would be bringing a new, in my mind, a collectibility threshold. Maybe I'm being too harsh there. But you're bringing a different line. That's difficult. Then the worry about significant credit risk and significant financing component, sequencing changes the answer. So you're not solving the issue that is being at present. I think living with alternative A and enhancing the indicators by going around the table between both the boards and asking what you think are the indicators that differentiate you between a price concession and a bad debt would help. And I have my own theory when I would say it's a price concession, when it is a bad debt. I think Gary alluded to a few of them, what he thinks about it. I think that's a more eminent way to go. And no matter what we do, we are not going to plug this hole. And I'm openly acknowledging that.
Well, PK has asked many of the questions that I was going to. This thing about the collectibility threshold, it seems to me that C effectively introduces a more explicit collectibility threshold, because would there be a case in which you say there is significant credit risk, therefore you get into this C and you adjust the revenue? Would you ever end up recognizing revenue given the constraint?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, you could, and I think what PK said, if portfolios exist, you probably will not have to, you'll pass the constraint because you'll be doing sort of more expected value type calculation of the amount of consideration you expect to be entitled to / collect for that sort of subset of contracts, and provide you've got good information to support that assertion, you'll probably pass the constraint.
So it's not really about the constraint, this, it's about the presentation.
No, but in some cases, the constraint will get triggered and you won't recognise revenue at the time of transfer. So it's going to depend on facts and circumstances. More likely, it would sort of, you would expect for one-off transactions, it might be more difficult to pass the constraint unless you've got good quality evidence.
Okay. How would you define significant? How would you propose to explain it?
Well, that's... We would probably say, and you know, this sort of reflects, you know, it's very fresh thinking, that we would probably try to use some of the ideas that we've got in the paper about alternative A and how you might assess sort of, you know, price concessions versus impairment. We might be able to borrow some of that thinking and repackage it slightly to help an assessment of significant credit risk. But we haven't gone to that extent of trying to work out exactly what we would do.
And this interaction between the significant credit risk and the significant financing component, does it work?
That would require more thought, I think, in terms of the implications. I think in the paper, or in the handout, sorry, we acknowledge that there are some issues associated with, as PK said, the sequencing.
Yeah, and I think we'd need to think about the interaction with the impairment proposals as well.
Yeah.
And just off the top of my head, we've also got a threshold on the impairment proposals, obviously, for sort of purchase credit impaired or originated credit impaired, which uses an incurred threshold. And we've got a sort of different mechanism there that we're using to adjust interest revenue in some circumstances. So we're getting quite a complex package.
It seemed to me that this would qualify for our originated credit impaired. We don't use that phrase.
Yeah.
But it's just becoming becoming very messy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, our initial thought was to try and explain alternative C in the case where there wasn't a significant financing component, because that's the clearest case where we can sort of demonstrate it. Obviously, if that has some support around the board table tomorrow, one of the things we will need to consider is just how you sort of scope that alternative C within the confines of the model as a whole? Do you give precedence to the significant financing component whereby, as per the staff draft, you reflect customer credit risk in the discount rate? Or should we give precedence to how you account for customer credit
risk? So is C, are we still saying that it is credit risk in C, or are we saying that because of the high level of credit risk, we are going to deem that it's a price concession? Because if it's the latter, I don't see the problem with impairment any more than we might have a problem at the moment, because presumably if under alternative A, you may look at the credit risk and say, well, that would indicate that it's variable consideration, it's a price concession, and presumably there's some sort of interaction between that and impairment right now that potentially is a problem, which I hadn't thought of before.
Well, I think to the extent that you deem there to be price concessions and it's uncertain as to what the amount will be, and you subsequently reassess the price concession is from period to period, that they will be adjustments to revenue. And provided they're adjustments to revenue, it's a contract asset, stays within the...
Well, it seems to me that if you're in alternative A example 3, that there can be no credit risk. By definition, we're saying all of the variability in the consideration isn't credit, it is price concession.
Price concession caused by...
Yes, price concession caused by customer credit, but we never have a bad debt.
That's right.
And therefore, the impairment proposals cannot apply, because there cannot be an impairment. So there isn't a problem. You're either doing impairment or you're doing price concession. You can't be doing both.
Of course, it would be double count.
But then I wonder what happens when you have a significant financing component. Presumably, if payment is in more than a year's time, you'd be discounting at a risk-free rate because there can't be any...
This accounting doesn't work for significant financing component.
It's
entirely different. You assess both the credit risk and the financing component as one end element. So that's a subtlety here. This is all works only when there is no significant financing component.
So it doesn't. So what do we do if there is a significant financing
component? We incorporate the discount rate.
You could apply... One option would be to apply the staff draft, which is credit risk is reflected in the discount rate used to discount the promised consideration. And then you effectively say, okay, well, that's a contract that has two parts. It has the provision of a loan, and the customer uses the proceeds of that loan to buy the goods or services for cash. So all the uncertainty about customer credit risk would be accounted for in the loan component of that transaction. That's our existing proposal.
Yeah, exactly the same point as the interaction between the IFRS 9, the impairment, and the price concession. So in the case you have a significant component of finance, then there is a possibility that you make a concession on the interest rate as well. So that's why I'm really confused. And in the alternative C, it is D. So therefore, not just the judgment, but the... with certain conditions, you have to judge whether it falls into the price concession or impairment. And then when it comes to the loan, then if you have counterpart which is deemed a significant credit risk, then you have to make a price concession perhaps on the interest rate as well. So then it will significantly affect our idea of IFRS 9's impairment. That is one point that we have already discussed. And the second point is about alternative B. You said that in the benefit of alternative B is we don't have to judge whether it's a price concession or impairment. That is the benefit of the alternative B. However, even alternative B, you have to disaggregate what is the revenue and what is the deducted amount. The question is, based on that idea, so you are saying that you have to show the subtotal. So this is the issue we debated over and over again, whether we should have subtotal or not. But as long as you say that the benefit of the alternative B is you don't have to worry about price concession of impairment, then that seems to me that you are expecting to require to present subtotal. Am I right? Is my understanding correct?
I would like to ask Philippe and Patricia to make their contributions and then...
Quickly. One way to analyze example 4 here is that you don't have a contract for 100. You have a contract for 60. You know from day one, from inception, that you don't expect to collect more than 60. So really, business-wise, you are entitled in your own decision to 60.
That's right.
So in that extreme case, I forget about the contractual notional price. I look at my business decision, which I took on day one to accept to negotiate with this customer with an expectation to collect 60. Hence, there is some logics to recording only 60 as revenue directly, because that is a business decision, which is quite different from other situations where you expect to have a right to 100, but you know there is some risk and you would book an expected loss provision. But still, your contract is 100. So I have some sympathy for the alternative C, but really I think it applies to very extreme situations where you know very well that you not even think about the 100.
But that would apply on alternative A as well. If it's a price concession and you know you're just getting 60, then you'd have the same answer.
Yes, and this notion of this entitlement could apply as well in alternative A, absolutely, because this constraint on the amount to book would apply. So I don't see a big difference. It's just that in one case, there is some risk, and it's better to show this risk on the P&L by showing this reduction on a line, which probably would be bad debt expense. In the extreme case, it's not even worth thinking about it because your decision was to accept 60. So the 40 price reduction doesn't matter.
Regarding alternative B, to Todd's point, if we go with alternative B, you're still going to need some of the clarifications and guidance that you propose in alternative A, because while alternative B takes some of that pressure off because of your net revenue line, there's still going to be a top line revenue, and so you're still going to need the guidance that you propose in A. I don't really see an advantage of C over A. I think A is much more transparent and is going to address, I believe, 99.9% of what we're worried about. What really worries me about C is that it seems to be an exception to the whole underlying premise of the standard that we're accounting for contracts with customers. Sort of going back to Weiwo's point that if the customer believes that they aren't going to have to pay the contract price, if they don't pay it, there'll be no significant penalty to them, then yeah, it's a concession, and I think we'd pick that up in A. But it seems to me that the way we're looking at C is just if there's significant credit risk, the customer would have you take back the merchandise, there would be a penalty to the customer, so they think they have to pay or they're going to suffer. That's a different thing, and by definition, if the customer doesn't know there's a concession, it's not part of the contract, and so we're accounting for something that isn't in the contract in C. I'm just a little concerned about whether it's a violation of the whole principle.
That's a good point, because the customer is presumably booking payable for 100.
It can't be a unilateral, right?
That was Pat's point in the beginning.
Okay. I think we have to continue with the next paper.
Yep. Ryan's going to tee up paper B. Can I turn it over to you, Brian?
Sure. Good morning. Paper 7B considers the accounting for contracts that cannot qualify to apply the revenue standard because they fail the criteria in paragraph 14.
Hold on. We cannot hear you.
Sure. Can you hear me if I talk louder?
Yeah, we got the volumes right up.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. So the staff had received questions for contracts that for contracts in which the entity receives consideration but failed the criteria in paragraph 14. And this paper represents our attempt to address some of those concerns. Appendix A of the paper presents paragraphs 14.1 to 14.3 of the staff draft. This guidance applies when consideration has been received but the contract failed the criteria in paragraph 14. It says that the consideration received may be recognized as revenue only if both of the following occur. The entity has no remaining obligations to transfer goods or services to the customer, and the consideration is non-refundable. If both of those conditions are met, the entity would derecognize the asset that is sold and recognize a restricted asset. That restricted asset would initially be measured at the same cost basis as the transferred asset, and then would subsequently be reduced by any non-refundable consideration that's received by the entity. So this effectively defers any profit until the entity's cost basis is recovered. If the two conditions are not met, then the non-refundable consideration is recognized as a liability and the asset is not derecognized. So we have received some feedback on this guidance that we had in the staff draft. Some supported this guidance, but had some concerns about the inclusion of cost derecognition guidance, the inclusion of guidance in general for transactions that do not qualify to be in the standard. Some pointed out that the income statement effect of this could be more favorable than if a contract passed 14, but variable consideration was present and the constraint kicked in which case a loss would be recognized as the asset sold is derecognized under our revenue standard. A couple other questions, one on the nature of the restricted asset and the impairment model that would apply to that restricted asset, as well as the timing of reassessment into the model. So the paper presents two alternatives. Alternative one is what we have in Appendix A, which was what's in the staff draft, paragraphs 14.1 to paragraph 14.3. And alternative two would prohibit revenue recognition for non-refundable consideration until the contract is essentially complete, meaning that all of the consideration is received, or it's canceled, for example, because the customer defaults, or upon a reassessment, which will continue to be a judgmental assessment about whether the entity passes paragraph 14 and gets into the standard. So under this alternative, the revenue standard would be silent on asset derecognition, and we would rely on existing U.S. GAAP and IFRS. The FASB would likely need to make some codification amendments to Topics 350 and 360 for sales of non-financial assets that would say that those assets are not derecognized when the entity receives non-refundable consideration. So a key consideration is whether the boards think that, you know, revenue should be recognized when non-refundable consideration is received in the form of a down payment or installment payment, or if the boards think that revenue should be precluded until the transaction is essentially complete. So the questions for the boards will be, one, should the revenue standard provide guidance for transactions that fail step one? And two, should that guidance be limited to addressing revenue recognition, or should it also address cost derecognition? So with that, I'll turn it over to the board for discussion.
Thank you. Note takers?
I have one question.
Yes, Amado.
So why do you believe it should be reassessed if they not meet paragraph 14 every period?
Right. So we think if an entity passes paragraph 14, there would never be a reassessment. But if an entity fails paragraph 14 at the beginning, which is a judgmental sort of qualitative consideration, they could still get in if at some point you believe that the customer is committed. So that's generally going to be, I would say, the reason for failing paragraph 14 will often be because a decision is made that the customer is not committed. But upon, you know, receiving more facts or as facts and circumstances change, it may become apparent that the customer is committed to the contract, in which case we don't think we should preclude someone or preclude an entity from recognizing revenue.
And remember, it's more than just the commitment. It's all, are the terms substantive?
Yeah.
So you, Amaro, you and I could sit down and have an initial discussion to talk about some initial terms. We wouldn't pass 14, but we could further those discussions and get to a point. And I think that's the type of thing that we were expecting to happen. But like Brian said, once you pass, we think you move through the model. You wouldn't, at a later point, having thought you passed, come back and say, oh, now something.
Philippe? Sorry, I'm not sure I understand properly. Can you clarify for me what is the restricted asset in paragraph 16? What is that asset?
Yeah, we didn't try. Go ahead, Crispin.
I mean, I do have a contract which fails. I receive some cash. Okay, so down payment. What is the asset we are talking about here to be tested for impairment?
You can say transfer to another asset.
Well, if I am a service provider, I don't have an asset to test.
Yeah, this is
only if I am selling a good, not a service. Right. And why should I test it for impairment? I mean, if the contract fails, I will sell this good to someone else. What is specific in this case that I have to test specifically this asset, this inventory piece, as opposed to any other situation? I don't have a contract, so I have inventory. Whether I have a kind of contract which fails or no contract, I still have an inventory piece. In any case, IS2 tells me I have to test for impairment. So because I have this kind of not bona fide contract or a contract which fails, why should I have a special impairment requirement as opposed to the normal one under IS2, which tells me if you can't sell it, impair it?
I think we were thinking about what they were describing is I have an item of inventory or a tangible asset that I have given to you.
I transferred it. Okay. All right.
So I can't classify it as inventory any longer because it's not available to be sold. It's with you. And so somehow classifying it differently to depict that change was what we were describing as that other restricted asset.
All right. Okay.
Chris, can I ask really the question? You know, I understand about the inventory to another asset. How about you provide a service? You incur different kinds of expenses, and but the criteria not met. How should company account for that service as a loss or put aside somewhere?
The important part here was that all performance had been complete. So in a service type arrangement, you know, the two conditions are first that you have performed everything under the contract, so it would only be at the very end of any service period, if you will, and you've received non-refundable consideration. I think we were always thinking these are probably fairly unique circumstances that you would find yourself in meeting both of those, that you have fully performed under what you believed was a contract that's deemed not a contract, and you've received some form of non-refundable consideration.
Also, this issue becomes less of an issue because I think the current thinking is paragraph 14 is only for bona fide transactions.
Mm-hmm.
So many transactions, in my mind, will pass through the gate of paragraph 14 now, the way we are currently thinking, so that for many transactions, this issue does not arise. So you pass the revenue 14 and you come into the full standard. So that's also another thing to think about.
Okay, are you ready to go to the next paper?
Yeah.
So I'll tee up paper 7C, 173C. So this paper deals with the constraints. So what happens when an entity does not have sufficient confidence to include its full estimate of the variable consideration in the transaction price? So how the entity would apply the minimums requirement. Now, the reason why we sort of brought this paper back is because we've received some feedback on the constraints on the minimums requirements. What we did in the staff draft is try to action your decision from December 2012. which was to delete paragraph 85 of the 2011 ED, which is referenced in this paper, and you may recall that the paragraph that restricted revenue recognition when there was a sales-based royalty on a license of intellectual property until such time that, those sales occur. So in December, we decided to delete that paragraph, but acknowledge that an entity would, in some cases, may only recognize zero as their minimum amount of revenue if the entity doesn't have sufficient confidence that amount would not be reversed. So this paper walks through two options. In paragraph 17 to 21, the first option is to stay with what we drafted in as the staff draft, which is also included in Appendix A of the paper, which is to draw a distinction between a performance obligation satisfied at a point in time or a performance obligation satisfied over time. That distinction will act as what will allow an entity to determine whether that minimum amount could be zero or not. So in other words, if the performance obligation is satisfied at a point in time, the entity would assess its variable consideration, assess the constraint, and the minimum amount. If the entity does not have sufficient confidence that it can include the full amount of variable consideration in the constraint, but yet it would be something much lower than that minimum amount would be zero if the performance obligation is satisfied at a point in time. However, if the performance obligation is satisfied over time, that minimum amount could be included in the transaction price and then included in the entity's measure of progress. The second option, which is in paragraphs 22 to 27 of the paper, is consistent or aligned more closely with the paragraph 85 that I just explained from the 2011 ED, and that is that that for some types of royalty-based consideration on licenses, those amounts would not be able to pass the constraint until the uncertainty is resolved in that case. So in terms of the staff recommendation, which is in paragraph 2, we didn't have a strong preference sort of one way or the other between option 1 and option 2, but we thought that option 1 is more preferable. And maybe we can now turn to sort of Appendix C, which maybe I can walk you through what option 1 explains more clearly. And option 1 was, as we proposed in the staff draft and the external review draft, which sort of many of you have seen, I think what we would like to do is provide some clarifications to address some of the feedback that suggested that it was a little bit too complex. One of the clarifications could be to include the decision tree that is in sort of Appendix C of the paper. And this decision tree really walks through sort of the questions an entity would consider when the consideration is variable. So if when the consideration is variable, the entity would estimate it. And if they cannot meet sort of all of if the full amount cannot be included in the transaction price, then the sort of bottom two boxes would require the entity to distinguish whether the performance obligation is satisfied at a point in time or over time, and only when it's satisfied over time can a minimum amount be included in the estimate of the transaction price. So I think the question for the board is whether you want to go with option 1, which is sticking to the staff draft and that distinction between point in time or overtime, or whether you want to go with option 2, which is more consistent with the 2011
ED. Doc, yes. This is an education session. Can I ask a silly question? Yes, so paragraph 15 and 16, this is the options considered but rejected. So you put those options on your paper. Mm-hmm. What is your intention?
But these options in paragraph 15 and 16 were options that we considered but rejected. And I think some of the reasons why we've rejected them are included there. And I think, in particular, the example on page 7 at the bottom of at the bottom of paragraph 15 outlines our concerns about, for example, when we're just relying on the sort of broader principles of the constraint, right, that it would result in sort of a pattern of revenue recognition that wouldn't necessarily tie to the entity's performance, right, particularly when it's a performance obligation satisfied at a point in time. Right. I think there was concern, and that was raised also on the 2010 ED,
right,
that the true-ups that may happen wouldn't be useful to users.
Yeah, but the reason why I said my question is silly question is this option could be one of the option which we could discuss as an alternative, or if, do you put this option completely off the table?
Well, I think we presented sort of why we rejected it, but of course I think it's in the paper, so you'd be able to discuss it.
We can discuss. To some extent.
Maybe on the same page, because man, you argue in paragraph 9 really that if you have would allow a kind of estimate of this minimum amount, that will distort what is the depiction of the revenue. And when you will say, okay, but that is only true for a point in time recognition. I think you can have the same situation for if you recognize revenue over time and have this minimum. So I have not understood why you're saying it is only for a point-in-time transaction and not for overtime, because the same pattern can argue to have to adjust and will not really depict the performance. Mm-hmm. So I really don't understand that, why it is only for point-in-time, not overtime. And then going back to 15, because I think I understand also the example in 15, but I don't understand why it does not really gives you an overview of the performance if you would follow that, because if you would go to your option one, you have also not really the performance, it's also not depicted in any time, because if it is then verifiable and you get the amount, you get, I think, a similar picture in the different years, and you not have then the performance only in 1 year. So it is really the performance and recognition is in a different period. And that is a problem. But we have already, I think, disclosure which should provide which performance you have recognized, but it is not the performance for a specific year. That is, I think, we have already in the standard. So I would really also with Tagman, I think if you go to paragraph 50, that would be more, I see it, in line with the principle which we have in the standard. And I don't understand why this pattern will not reflect it with the additional disclosure which we have in the standard.
I think the reason and the rationale that sort of I think we tried to articulate in paragraph 9 about the distinction between sort of a performance obligation satisfied at a point in time and a performance obligation satisfied over time is that when the performance obligation is satisfied over time, including that minimum amount, you're right, there could be true-ups over time, but the entity is performing over time, so some of those true-ups would relate to the entity's performance and some of them will relate to sort of changes in estimates. But because the entity is sort of measuring its progress as it goes, that does have some informational value because it could tie to its performance. But I think in terms of the performance obligation satisfied at a point in time, the example that we illustrated on page 7, that true-up doesn't tie to its performance because it happened at the beginning of the contract, and it doesn't tie to cash. And I think when we were talking to a number of users about this back in October, November time, users really said the best information for them, if an entity can't estimate or can't get a good handle on sort of the full amount of the consideration, that sort of knowing when the cash is received is the most useful information for them in this case. And I think, you know, even since the decision in December, I think we've also heard from a number of preparers who are concerned that sort of the outcome that we've outlined in this example on page 7 doesn't tie to their performance or to sort of cash collected. And I think they've been concerned that this is not an outcome that reflects the economics of their contract.
We heard that feedback overwhelmingly on the 2010 ED, which is why we had the requirement in paragraph 85, which is basically option 2 in this paper, in the 2011 ED. It was because, you know, preparers and users all said that almost, well, it wasn't unanimous, but you know, the vast majority of them said that that pattern of revenue recognition in this example would not be helpful or useful. So that was the origination of paragraph 85, and that pattern was broadly supported in the 2011 ED for those type of contracts.
But I don't understand, because what we want to have is a matching really of the revenue recognition with the control, which is then transferred to the customer. That is a problem here. But it doesn't achieve that in neither of these cases. And then we distinguish, I think, artificially with a point in time and with an overtime, because we have the same problem, I think, with the contracts which are then reflected overtime. And that is, I think, I don't see a kind of principle here. It is solving one problem, point in time, but also then what we trying to solve is really the matching of revenue recognition with control to the customer is also not achieved. It's then based on cash. But then only for one part and not for, I think, another part. And that is where I'm struggling.
Christian?
I actually have the same confusion as Martin. It seems to me that the explanation in paragraph 9 of the staff paper I find very confusing. So I understand that user said when there was the consideration couldn't be reliably estimated, that recognizing it on a cash basis would be best. So that's what we're doing in point in time, right? Why aren't we doing that when the performance is overtime? Because we want to show the performance. So it seems like we've got two different objectives. One, we're showing when the cash is received, and the other one, we're showing performance. I think we should either be showing them both when the cash is received or both to illustrate performance. I'm just confused about what we're trying to accomplish.
I'm probably in the same situation. I think we should have a clear principle, which is the one we have in Appendix D, that you book consideration, variable consideration, only when you are comfortable that there will be no subsequent reversal. And I'm okay with having a special regime for sales-based royalties, which is an exception. You say here you are more restrictive. You don't book based on your level of comfort, you book based on the evidence, the cash is there, or the sales have taken place. This is an exception to the general regime. And that is very well explained in Appendix D, I guess. Now, the way the staff is proposing to deal with that, having two different streams based on point in time or overtime, and the fact that you have to apply this chart to make this work, is just creating an extra level of complexity. Many constituents are complaining that this revenue model is complex, and they fail to understand. And we are just continuing to add layers of complexity to it. Let's keep it simple. Let's have a clear principle, maybe an exception for sales-based royalty, that's it, that's fine.
Gary?
Yeah. I mean, I'm sort of where my first three colleagues were here, too, but let me ask the question a little bit differently. A lot of this comes around the estimated value. And I appreciate 56.2 gives all these reasons why it's hard to estimate. But where's the control? Says, someone says, I know all that, but I'm just going to make my estimate on day one just low. You know, you're trying to book a transaction today. You've got, presumably, some fixed consideration you're booking and some variable. But it still revolves around management's estimate. So what's the control when the company says we're going to estimate the low? Even when it's low, I still got all these other problems about a period of time, factors outside of my control, et cetera, et cetera. But none of that changes if the beginning estimate by management is just low.
Right.
Whether it's prudence, whether it's they just don't agree with the variable consideration, whatever. I don't see a control, you know, any place in here, or maybe there isn't. Maybe that's more of an audit issue or governance issue.
We've included, so in Appendix A, we included an excerpt from the staff draft that sort of deals with the constraint, perhaps unfortunately, but the paragraph just preceding that, it's paragraph 55, and it provides some guidance for people on how to estimate the variable consideration. And it does give sort of two methods that an entity would use, and that's an expected value or a most likely method. And an entity would use the method that sort of best depicts sort of the consideration that they expect to be entitled. So there is some guidance around the estimation techniques before you get into the constraint.
Okay, so not having been the last 4 years in this where you aren't, I should read 55 in advance, because I read 56 that, you know, in your entirety, and it says, what it really says is you book to your comfort level. That's what the collective combination of paragraph 56 tells me. You don't need to go beyond it, but if you're comfortable it's greater than zero, you have to do something. That's sort of how I would internalize this and this takeaway. Is that a fair summary?
I think so. I think so. 55 allows you to come to an estimate of a number, and then 56 says, well, do you think you might reverse that number? I think that's the way 56 is asking. So if you think that there is going to be a reversal, then you get into sort of the minimums requirements and, you know, does it need to be lower than that? And then we start asking the question, if you stick with option one, is it a performance obligation satisfied at a point in time or over time? Which is, I think that's a little bit of what we've tried to illustrate in the flow chart. In a second.
Flow chart was good, because I said 55, how you create your estimate, 56 is what your comfort zone is.
Yeah, that's
and
right.
If it's your comfort zone greater than zero, you know, you have to do book at least something. That's how I would sort of, at a high level, net this out.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, again, because it depends on whether it's a like, if you stick with option one, it depends on whether that's a performance obligation satisfied at a point in time or over time. So if you've got to this minimum amount, but you have a performance obligation satisfied at a point in time, you may end up in zero. So you may not book anything in that case.
Maybe not. Now, I understand zero is a choice or is an outcome in some cases.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
EK?
I think on behalf of myself, the entire board, we should apologize to the staff for making this more complicated than it is needed. Okay? I say that because I think we have been jerking around quite a bit on this issue. And this has become one of the most contentious issues in our run-up to the final standard. The reason behind is that we are not clear what we want to do. I'm not talking you as a staff, but we as a board. I take the responsibility here. I think I will talk about the two alternatives that you have on the table rather than what you have rejected, and some of the points that those three made are included in my comments. The issue that the staff marginally supports the keeping the staff draft does not include reassessment. So let me give you an example to illustrate the point. Again, I'll take my favorite Tom Cruise movie example. I released that movie on Thanksgiving Day in the United States. So my year end is December 31st. I'm Paramount Pictures, or I don't know who Tom Cruise works with, but let's say it's Paramount Pictures. So on November 25th or 26th, the movie is released. It's a very good movie. In a week's time, statistical models of the movie house can predict with a 97% accuracy that this will be the revenues from this movie worldwide distribution. Now, within 7 days, I know what my number is going to be pretty much from the movie distribution, not from the video cassettes, not from the DVDs or from the anything, but from the movie, I know 97% accuracy, I get the amount. If I understand the staff's proposal as it stands, because there's no reassessment, you would book zero on day one. You will book zero on the day you have come to the conclusion with 97% accuracy, you will book it. And you will collect, as and when you collect cash, you will book it. To me, honestly, without reassessment in my fact pattern, I think this starts the revenue or the core principle that is, when the performance obligation is satisfied, revenue should be recognized. That's the core principle I see it. And that core principle is violated heavily in this situation, in the example I gave. So I think the the one which Henry mentioned and the one which Philip mentioned is that when we put the 2010 ED, there was confusion what should we do with sales-based royalties, right? So we have inserted para 85 in the 2011 ED specifically to address that issue. And if I recollect correctly, and this is time is passing by and I'm getting older and older, but I think the users of the financial statements, the user group did not object to para 85. It is only some academicians and some standard setters opposed to 85, but when you look at the users of the financials, they said we are happy with the sales-based royalties. Mm-hmm. My request to the staff, my fellow board members tomorrow is that why not reinsert 85? You will release all this tension because you have a tension here between point in time and over time, and some of the questions people are asking. You don't need all those things. I think Philip said it very well. If you have an exception, and if you know it is, and you have a general principle, but you have an exception, we can live with it. 85 does that. And users of the financial statements have no objection. Why not just live with it?
You're creating confusion now in my mind. Sorry. Paragraph 56.5 here says, you book when uncertainty is resolved. It's nothing to do with cash. In your case, by year end, December 31, you will have 6 weeks of sales of your movie. So you will have data, actual data of the distribution revenue for the 6 weeks.
You will book 6 weeks of data, but yes. You will know the entire movie.
In the discussion with the staff, you say don't reassess, you book nothing, because you don't have the cash.
After one week, 7% accuracy, the entire movie proceeds.
But after 1 week, I don't have financial statements, so why should I bother after 1 week? I don't draw financial statements on that 1 week after.
If you open the movie on December 25th.
Yeah.
Okay, alright, then okay. Then you have to reassess. If you have evidence, strong evidence, even if you don't have the cash, like you, I would reassess.
But this
because my uncertainty is resolved. My uncertainty is resolved at that time.
Yeah, but this will not, the staff's proposal does
not
allow
you. No, sorry, but paragraph 56.5 says uncertainty is resolved. So if I apply this paragraph, I'm no longer uncertain. I have confidence.
No,
100%, maybe 97% according to your model.
No, because the very end says when the sales occur in a sales basis. So in the PK's example, this could be.
Chang Wu?
Yes, thank you. Just one question. Listen, paragraph 15, you said the users are not happy with their general, maybe, constraint principle. So this response from users is based on our almost final review paper. So if that's a yes, then why do those users are not happy with our maybe some tentative?
A lot of our interaction with users was back in sort of October, November, December when we were just before this issue came to the board in December, so it's not necessarily on the back of the external review draft. That was a lot of our feedback that we received then. But it was, we did consider relying sort of in paragraph 15 whether we could rely just on the sort of general principle, and we discussed an example similar to the one on page 7 with users at that time.
So I just wonder, you know, our general principle was a little changed from the 2011 ED. Mm-hmm. So if the real users want to zero revenue for sales-based royalty, if they want zero revenue there, then I'd like to know why those users have such an opinion. And if they see our a more improved general principle, then what are their reactions to those general principles?
I think even though the principle has changed, I think from or the, I think it's probably better to say the way we've articulated the principle has changed from the 2011 ED, because I think you may remember in 2011 that the constraint was sort of focused on the word reasonably assured, and it lived in step five. So we've changed the way we've articulated it, but it hasn't fundamentally changed the outcomes. And often a lot of our conversations with users focus on outcomes because that's sort of what they see. So I think, you know, even though we have changed how we've articulated the constraint or articulated that principle, the outcomes won't necessarily change. So it would still be the same. And I think the users, I think the reasons why they preferred sort of seeing revenue as sort of the sales-based royalties occur until when that uncertainty is resolved is because to them it's more meaningful to have information that ties to something. So in the other extreme, you'd have these true-ups of estimates that doesn't tie to the entity's performance and doesn't tie to cash. So then they're relying on sort of how the entities made those estimates and how those judgments have occurred, whereas in the other case, it is tied to something that has happened.
It seems to me in the investor's case, you know, maybe they might would like to know about some very low amount, even though some expected value amount of even though their revenue is so, you know, variable. So maybe rather than having some zero revenue, they might have a 10 or 15. Maybe they are, even though the contract amount is 100, but based on all information, you know, say even including sales-based and royalty revenue transaction, you might say we expect 10 of their total amount of, you know, 100 now, based on all the facts and circumstances. So if the prudent regulation might think the conservative solution might be better, so just ignore everything until the cash is coming. So we are relying on more non-accrual basis, like in some of the IFRS 9 impairment. So, but it seems to me if we just stick to the general principle, you know, we are going to use some expected value principle rather than constraint, collectible constraint, for example. This is also related to Agenda Paper 7A. Basically, all those things are related to uncertainties. So how do we handle these uncertainties? If we stick to the general principle, then we should go there, and we should provide more guidance how to make a precise and expected amount of the transaction. So it seems to be much better than giving us some kind of specific, type of rule. If we have some kind of a point in a time transaction, you should do like this. Another time, you should do like this. You know, it's a kind of it seems like a rule-based norm. So I prefer more general principles, then we can eliminate every details, you know, about all these three papers. That's why.
I totally appreciate PK's example. I think the other one that we heard more consistently about it was a longer term to life where you sell a good or a license for 10 years and you don't have knowledge in the first couple years of what the sales are going to be, and you have to estimate out that 10-year period or in some cases into perpetuity the period. And so you do get better evidence in year two or three, and then you could estimate the next, say, 7 years. So then you would have enough evidence at that point in time. Do you report it then? And then circumstances may change. And if we're talking about a pharmaceutical drug, it may come then off patent somewhere later on, and that could reverse where you expect. And so I think it was that type of fact pattern that was really put in front of us. And I appreciate if it's a shorter time frame that resolution happens, I think sometimes it's easier to think about, but it was those longer contracts.
If I take scale of that.
Yeah.
8-5,
right? With a non-reassessment, though. But we
yeah.
Can, yeah.
And only for a specific transaction where users wanted that. If we do that, that's how it runs through the model.
And Philippe made a good point, I think, about complexity. Mm-hmm. And you know, I sat in various meetings where early drafts of what was in the staff draft were discussed, and you know, the complexity around the constraint that Philippe alluded to was very much on people's mind. And when you drilled into that discussion, it was all around the minimums, not the general principle of the constraint. So, you know, we've tried to improve it, but you can't get around it, that it does make the constraint quite complicated, and therefore, you know, that may be an advantage of alternative two over alternative one.
So, would be another ten option, you mean, bringing 8-5 bluntly back?
I think we would be alternative two in the paper is
alternative two. How paragraph 56.3 together with 56.5 treats the PK's fact pattern.
It's another way to say, based on my model for the movie, based on the evidence I get in the first days, critics are good, the customers show up and there is a good success as expected. My uncertainty is resolved. My model is good. I can reassess. Why don't we do this?
Yeah, but can the staff clarify to me how those two paragraphs treats the fact pattern described by PK?
So in the movie case, point in time movie, when the uncertainty is resolved, that's when the revenue would be recognized. So in PK's case, in, after sort of 1 week, you wouldn't necessarily be able to recognize your revenue for the whole period. It'd be as that those sales occur, as an example.
So, sorry?
So you wouldn't necessarily...
You wouldn't.
But again, it's only for the subset, so it's only for licenses of intellectual property.
Yeah, that's clear.
So if the movie came out on December 25th, your year end is December 31st, you would have knowledge of 6 days of sales. You would recognize that, but not recognize what you expect for the next 3 months going into the new year.
Just to clarify. Yeah. Thank you.
But it makes it very clear, 85 makes it very clear you don't do it. When you go to principle that is there in the alternative one, you'll be confusing why you will not do the reassessment. In 85, it's a known, nobody is going to confuse themselves why we should not do it. So it's a straight cut.
Yeah. No, I just want to understand that we are not bringing the 85 back, but actually all the discussion is somewhat indicating that maybe the option as described in Appendix D would solve this without bringing 85 back.
Let me just say one thing, though. What the staff's draft of the option one is doing is expanding 85 to everybody. Mm-hmm. So that's what is the outcome of the staff's option one. It says for all points in time, just do it. Don't ignore the reassessment. That's not fair. The question that came about is only for the intellectual property, license of intellectual property issue came about. That can be solved with 85. I should have said that. 85's option one is spreading to everybody.
And just one clarification, though. You still, in option one, if you have a point-in-time item and you pass the constraint, you would still recognize. So it is slightly different than...
Yeah, expected value, which is the point I made in 70.
That's right.
Okay. We're going to have lunch, and we will meet again at 1 o'clock.
I'm very confused.